This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
7:47 in the morning, you're listening to The Morning Run with Shazana and Xiaoning. Now, on Wednesday, EPF CEO Datuk Sri Amir Hamza said that Malaysia needs a better living wage mechanism that balances between the demand of employers and employees without causing too much disruption. The rationale being that if wages were to rise, EPF contributions would be better in tandem, resulting in a better savings rate. And this is on the back of the revelation that there have been 101 billion ringgit pandemic-related withdrawals since 2020, which has resulted in 48% of EPF members having less than 10,000 ringgit in their accounts.
Now, Bank Negara has previously defined the living wage as the level of income needed for a household to afford a minimum acceptable standard of living. However, Bank Negara also estimated that more than a quarter of households in Kuala Lumpur were earning below the living wage. And just for some guidance, if you're a single person, that figure is 2,700 ringgit, which is very different from a minimum wage debate that is still ongoing. Now, so what is the underlying issue of Malaysia's wage problem and how can a better living wage mechanism actually be implemented?
For some thoughts on this, we have on the line with us Firdaus Rosli, Chief Economist at Mark. Good morning, Firdaus. Thanks as always for joining us. Now, EPF has said that Malaysia needs a better living wage mechanism. What do you think that would look like?
Hi, good morning, Shaz and Xiaoning. I have three things to say. This is a very complicated topic. But first of all, I think the living wage is a fairly new concept. So it is unlike the minimum wage that became law in 2013. So we have to take that into consideration first because this is new for us. Secondly, we need to establish the differences between the national minimum wage, average monthly salaries and wages, as well as the living wage. More often than not, we get tangled into the three and then think that one is actually the other, but in fact, these three are completely different things. Number one is that the national minimum wage is statutory across all sectors, all salaried employees, whether local or foreign, determined by the average absolute monthly household poverty line income. Secondly is the average wage, which is simply the average, the overall average wage divided by the total number of workforce in the country. And thirdly is the living wage, which we've been talking about. But that is based on the cost of living in a specific locality, not necessarily the state, although many countries do it at the national level. The third thing that I want to say is that I foresee that this is an extremely complex case for Malaysia because getting the right number can be highly problematic. Why I say this is because, number one, lifestyle choices of Malaysians are completely different. Spending patterns are different and individual budgets are also different. So let me just break this down. We live far from, well, most Malaysians live far from the place of work. Not many of us can commute less than 10 km a day. So the mode of transportation matters to all of us, which is why we are highly sensitive to the movements of retail oil prices. So that can be a consideration for the living wage, which can be complicated because you can be working in Kuala Lumpur but live in Selangor. But which part of Selangor? So that's different. We cannot compare Gombak and Petaling Jaya because these two are in Selangor but in two specific localities with two different costs of living. And then let's just take food, for example, now. So let's just take rice. What kind of rice? We don't eat the same kind of rice. Is it Thai rice, Vietnamese rice? Do we consume the same kind of diet? What are other related considerations that related to something that is staple but not in the eyes of the statistics, like mobile phones? Do we use different kinds of mobile phones? So, you know, internet access. How many gigabyte do we want? What is the basic gigabyte need per person? So, I think all in all, we have to get the basics right first. And the basic thing is to beef up the existing national wage mechanism, not on others. And why do I say this? Because, first of all, there are questions I need to raise. Why is our PLI lower than the minimum wage? Because both were revised in the same year, which was in 2020, but simple calculations would say that the PLI should be half of the national minimum wage, right? But it should have been 2,400, not 2,208. So why are there differences here? And secondly, do we have enough labour inspectors to go around the country to ensure the proper enforcement of the national minimum wage? Are we sure that foreign workers are compensated fairly according to the national minimum wage? And why do some foreign workers are being paid less than the median wage, which was also probably lower than the national minimum wage?
But Firdaus, I have a general question, and that is, do you think Malaysians in general are just underpaid for what for the work they do? Do we have this situation, especially for, let's say, the younger graduates, those that are entering the job market? Because the data suggests that. And what can be done to improve it?
You see, this is a very complicated question topic, like what I mentioned earlier, because when we talk about the entrance of new graduates, you know, the instant reaction that we have is that newly graduates in economic centres, right, like Kuala Lumpur, Klang Valley, Penang, Johor, etc. So, you know, even this has its own complication because the cost of living in these areas are very different.
Yes.
So, to answer your question, whether we are underpaid, even that is not entirely clear for me because it depends on the hourly work that we do and how much we are compensated based on hourly wage. See, the thing is for Malaysia, right? We overly focus on the national minimum wage at the from the perspective of a monthly wage, which is 1,200. But what if I were to work less than 40 hours a week? Am I being paid according to the minimum wage of 5.77 ringgit, I think, per hour? So, you know, and even if I don't get that kind of compensation, if I choose not to work 40 hours a week, are there proper enforcements to ensure that I get that amount? So, it's not entirely clear to me, I'm afraid.
Okay, because, you know, one of the issues that we keep having with different commentators is that, in the first place, our economic structure in Malaysia isn't working to our advantage, right? And that needs to be fixed first before, let's say, we can move on to paying better wages, having higher productive jobs. Do you think this is a scenario? If we focus on that, then basically Malaysians will achieve a living wage. Mm-hmm. So sort that out first before we look at what is the definition of a living wage.
Yes, yes, you're right. I always prefer to look at the basics first before we go to another level of policies altogether. So there are a couple of things that I can mention here. Number one is that there is an absence of collective bargaining. So, you know, various reforms have been undertaken by the government, which I completely agree with the government's efforts so far. But, you know, changes are coming, but they're not telling the public that, yes, you know, changes are coming, so be prepared kind of thing. Secondly, inflation rate is also a factor because low inflation would lead to low wage growth. That's as simple as that. So we have price level intervention since, what, Merdeka days, and the Price Control and Anti-Profiteering Act is completely outdated because we fictitiously suppress costs. But in reality, it will go up eventually as supply restrictions remain the same over time. So the right thing to do is probably to ease supply and allow the market to achieve the desired equilibrium rather than to intervene at the price level. The third one is investment incentives. The thing is, the wage level determines the type of industry we attract or we create, and vice versa. So we can't say that, okay, let's have this wage and then, you know, we're going to be a high-income nation tomorrow. Things just don't work that way. You know?
Right.
So our incentives are also outdated because our neighbouring countries are offering pretty much the same. So these are the structural problems that I see.
Okay. I think you've touched the surface on a range of complexities in this discussion that's going to require more time to discuss, and we'll surely follow that. But while we have you on the line, Firdaus, let's turn our attention to Bank Negara's Monetary Policy Committee meeting yesterday, and they've maintained the OPR at 1.75%. Was this something that you expected?
Yes, very, very much so. Because we envisage that Bank Negara will express its cautious stance in maintaining the assessment of the economy, the domestic economy, more importantly, as well as the inflation outlook. So there are a couple of things where we highlighted in our pre-report. Yeah? So number one, we don't think that Malaysia is ready for monetary normalization yet because demand-side recovery is still very poor. So it is not automatic. Amid the supply restrictions of late since September, end of August last year, So the government has been overemphasizing on COVID-19 data and to ensure that, you know, get out and vaccinate, you know, vaccinate yourself, get a booster, get your kids vaccinated as well. But, you know, in alongside that number of cases skyrocketed, and that would create some kind of a fear in people to spend and, you know, go on their daily lives. And this has translated into Google mobility data, where since February, people are staying more at home, working more from home, and not spending as much in retail. So, but having said that, financial vulnerabilities has been contained, but we don't see a skyrocket kind of outlook for asset prices, for example, because demand is still relatively very weak.
So, Firdaus, your house view, what is the hikes expected for this year? Are you expecting 1 or 2, 25 bips, 50 bips by year end?
You know, to be honest, Xiaoding, we anticipated that the normalization will take place in the second half of this year. Mm. But now with the Ukraine-Russian war is taking, you know, one step after another, so we're not entirely sure. But at this point of time, we still stand by our earlier note that it's going to happen after second half and not anytime earlier.
All right, Firdaus, thanks very much for speaking to us. That was Firdaus Rosli, Chief Economist at Mark, throwing into question just how many rate cuts will happen. Mm. There's just so much uncertainty right now. But forecasting that recovery it'll come after in the second half of the year.
Basically, a rate hike is likely he's still forecasting one for the second half of 2022.
All right. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.